The other major story today, aside from the death of Lyndon Johnson, the tragic death, and the hopes for peace in Vietnam, is the decision of the United States Supreme Court. It handed down a historic decision about abortion. The court said in a 7-2 decision that in the first 3 months of pregnancy, only the woman and her physician may decide whether she may have an abortion. In the second 3 months, all the state may do is regulate abortion procedures. And only in the final 3 months of pregnancy can the state forbid abortion. The court ruled in cases from Texas and Georgia, but all 50 states are effective, whatever their laws.
NBC News interrupting its programming on January 22, 1973, to announce both the death of a president and the decision in Roe v. Wade that protected the right to an abortion. Before then, abortion hadn't really been politicized in the United States, but that moment set off a 50-year crusade by abortion opponents that will likely culminate this summer with the overturning of Roe and another landmark abortion case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. We're going to talk about the history of the anti-abortion movement, its rhetoric, and where it might go from here with Jennifer Holland. She's a history professor at the University of Oklahoma and author of the book Tiny You, A Western History of the Anti-Abortion Movement. Jennifer, welcome to Press Play.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's go way, way back to the 19th century and the early part of the 19th century, well before modern medicine. And abortion obviously wasn't politicized then, but it also wasn't considered necessarily a bad thing. It was considered part of women's health care, right?
Right. It was not illegal, except for in later parts of pregnancy. American law was based on English common law, and that meant abortion was only illegal after something called quickening, when a woman felt a fetus move, which was somewhere between the 4th and 6th month in pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And so before that, abortion was really an everyday kind of experience, that birth control and abortion were sort of fused together. People would grow these herbs or know what herbs to grow to what they called at the time, restore your menses. And only after quickening was abortion illegal. And that was at a point where some believed that the fetus became a potential life. But of course, also those abortions became much more dangerous.
Who was performing the abortions back then?
Well, midwives would have played a central role. They really were the source of women's reproductive health care and really all of it, including abortion, but also aiding birth. But people also would have sort of known what to use often, too. These would have been remedies handed down through especially generations of women. And then sort of in the 19th century, gradually you have a host of people who start marketing sort of solutions to pregnancy through a lot of euphemisms.
Like what?
Well, they were like uterine elevators. These were often mixed up with birth control, but especially when these things became illegal to be advertised, they really had to escalate their euphemisms. Sometimes they just say, like, copper mold, you know, it really was dependent on the listener to really know what they were talking about.
So this is the early part of the 19th century. When does this change and abortion become something more regulated in the medical profession?
Yeah. This really begins in earnest really after the Civil War, that you start having a group of professionally trained doctors who really lead a crusade to make abortion illegal from conception till birth. And doctors in this moment were not what we imagine now. They didn't necessarily have more medical knowledge. They did not have better medical outcomes. Their medical training sometimes involved classes, and sometimes you just bought your degree. And they were competing with a whole host of other practitioners. I mean, it really was medical anarchy in the 19th century.
Wow.
And so they were in a process of trying to distinguish themselves from all these other medical providers, and especially for those dealing with reproductive health care, differentiating themselves from midwives. And so a handful of doctors made the claim that, in fact, they knew that life began at conception, and that quickening was an artificial boundary. And this group of doctors convinced the American Medical Association, the brand new American Medical Association, to make this a key part of their advocacy. So they pressed state legislatures to impose these laws alongside other really important professionalizing measures like regulations about who can provide medicine in states. States didn't have those. And so gradually, state by state, this is successful. They convince legislators that it's doctors who really know when life begins, not midwives, and certainly not women themselves.
And so when does it become broadly illegal in the United States?
Well, 1900 is when every state bans abortion from conception to birth. And also, they have one exception, and that is when a woman's life is at stake. But importantly, in these laws, the only person, the only type of person who could say, like, whether a woman's life was truly at stake or not was a doctor. So doctors remain this essential gatekeeper. So the period where it's illegal in the United States everywhere is sort of 1900 to 1967. That's the period of really full abortion legality with only one loophole.
And what happens in 1967?
Well, 1967 is when the first state in the United States, Colorado, reforms its abortion law. And the conversation hadn't begun in 67. It had been going on for a decade, but really escalated in the previous few years, in the mid-60s. A bunch of abortion reformers had been pressing state legislatures to add a few more exceptions. They really were not initially asking for full legal abortion. They wanted to add rape exception, incest, and if the woman's mental health was at stake. But immediately, you know, people who pass these laws realize they're insufficient because they basically just add a new gatekeeper. Now psychiatrists are the ones who are having to determine whether a woman's mental health is at stake. And what does that mean? Does it mean that she just has to say, I am considering suicide, or is there something else? And so psychiatrists become this essential cog in this wheel. And some openly reject this and just start, you know, allowing any woman who comes to them the exception, whereas others are much more rigid.
So we're talking about the medical establishment in control here.
Yeah.
As the gatekeepers, medical doctors and psychiatrists.
Mm-hmm.
How did the religious right get involved?
Well, you know, I think that it's a little, perhaps was surprising that they did if we entered the world of the late 60s, because in the late 60s, the most outspoken religious people around abortion were advocating for more access to legal abortion. But when these states begin to consider opening up their abortion laws, then you start having small groups of religious people begin to form sort of the modern anti-abortion movement. There were a majority of the groups were white Catholics with the smattering of other religious people. And they start petitioning their states. And then after Roe, they move sort of out of a state-by-state-based system and become sort of a much more national movement. But really, the religious contours of the movement, majority white Catholics with a handful of others, remains true throughout much of the 1970s. So you do not have yet what we imagine as the religious right until the late 70s, when white evangelicals join and also white Mormons also join, though they're always sort of more subsidiary members of that coalition. And I think so the anti-abortion movement helps build the religious right by building those coalitions that would become the core of this political and religious coalition.
And then how does it become a key part of the Republican Party and the Republican Party's platform from the 80s on?
So the movement was not initially partisan at all. It was really a mix of, you know, Democrats and Republicans, and especially Catholics were more likely to vote Democrat, right?
No.
And so it's not that they were already a part of Republican politics, but the movement realizes pretty early on that they need a partisan vehicle for their politics. This is a moment where the parties are being reshaped. Before, both were pretty committed to sort of a nuclear family with a patriarch at its head. But that had been shifting, that the feminist movement had been remaking the Democratic Party in certain ways and pushing them to reconsider those politics. So by 1976, the anti-abortion movement realizes the Democrats are not going to be their party. And the Republicans are very much open to those voters who are going to help their candidates get elected. And so 1976 is when the Republican Party first puts an anti-abortion plank on their platform. But, you know, for a long time, the Republican Party was sort of often tepid allies. they would say the right things in order to get elected. They really relied on those voters, but they didn't always follow through. And it's really not until the late 90s where you have a lot of these socially conservative religious right leaders, right, like James Dobson and Focus on the Family, who really put their foot down and say, we're no longer going to be a part of a big tent party. We're no longer going to be good foot soldiers. We are not going to vote for people unless they actually follow through when they're in office. And I think we see the effects of that in the 21st century, that emphasis on really demanding a uniform political opinion on this issue within the party.
Well, I'm fascinated as to how that was translated to voters, because for many, many years, public opinion hasn't shifted. Most people are in favor of some form of abortion rights.
Yeah.
And most people are in favor of Roe.
Yeah.
So how was the right and the anti-abortion movement, how were they able to convince voters to hold this over their elected representatives and turn this into such a strong political message?
Yeah, they weren't a majority, but they didn't need to be. What the movement had done so well is that it had entered very particular intimate spaces of people's lives, like churches, homes, schools, and convinced them that this was not only an important political issue, but the only political issue. And so by the late 90s, they have a constituency of Americans for whom this is the only issue that matters. And so they are going to come to the polls and vote in a way that they might not, or other people who don't care as much might not. And so because they are such a reliable voting base, they held more sway than perhaps their numbers might suggest. They weren't a majority, but they swayed elections at key moments. So that made them an incredibly powerful group, especially in wave elections in the 21st century. It means that they're not just electing Republicans, they're electing Republicans who are maybe themselves anti-abortion activists or ideologues, or at least they know what they need to do once they get in office.
It's interesting that this is also being spoken about as a civil rights issue, the rights of the unborn child versus demonizing the woman as someone who is sexually irresponsible or has too many freedoms. But I'm also interested in how this has become a culture warrior issue. In other words, even if you perhaps aren't necessarily anti-abortion, that's not your issue, you identify with it because it's part of the political messaging and part of the messaging of the political tribe you ascribe to.
Yeah, I think that it compels enough people that the movement's been able to make it a priority. And then for other people who are partisan, as you say, part of a tribe, then it might not be their issue, but it's so core to the party that they can't really separate out from the people they want to elect or the party they want to elect from these politics. And because we have two parties, there's really aren't many alternatives, especially as this powerful movement was pushing the party in one direction. Others probably couldn't get off the train in the same kind of way.
Well, now that the movement has won its biggest victory, or apparently has won its biggest victory, we don't know for sure yet, but it looks like they have. What's next?
Well, I think that the movement has finally, you know, I think it seems like they're going to overturn Roe, which is the issue they've been seeking forever, but it is not the end game. Abortion activists differed in strategy, but their end goal has always been the same, and it's not to return it to the states. It is to end abortion everywhere. And I think the only exception that people can agree on is, you know, if a woman's life is at stake, a pregnant person's life is at stake. So I think that's the next step for the movement. I mean, the movement has to try that at federal levels and also try to convince the court of that. But of course, now they also will be in the position of actually governing, that in red states that have been able to sort of prove their anti-abortion credentials by simply passing anti-abortion laws that never go anywhere. Now, once it's returned to them, they not only will have to pass those laws, but they will have to figure out how to implement them. And of course, deep red states are going to have to stop medical migrations out into other states, and they're going to have to stop abortion pills from coming in. So they're going to have to figure out how to police both of those things in earnest. And they're going to now finally have this opportunity they've been seeking, which is, does this great hope, this, you know, anti-abortion utopia that the movement has been imagining for 50 years, will it be realized? Will women and pregnant people be better off without legal abortion? And we are going to be confronted with the outcome of this. And the movement's going to have to reckon with that in real ways, in a way that it hasn't had to for 50 years.
Well, I want to thank you so much. That was fascinating.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jennifer Holland, history professor at the University of Oklahoma and author of the book Tiny You, A Western History of the Anti-Abortion Movement. Coming up, will abortion be a key issue in the midterm elections, possibly preventing a Republican takeover? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, for Democrats, there is a possible silver lining if the Supreme Court overturns Roe. They're hoping that will help them in the upcoming midterms, that women will be animated much as they were when Donald Trump was elected president and go to the polls for them. Republican candidates who are hoping to focus on issues like inflation are now having to defend their views on abortion, and Democrats who are looking to pivot from talking about the high price of gas can run on reproductive rights. But will that change what is expected to be a GOP takeover of the House in November? Jeremy White is here now. He is California politics reporter for Politico. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Madeline.
Well, let's talk about some swing districts here in California in places like Orange County. So we've seen some shifts between the parties in some of these congressional districts. Are the candidates in those districts particularly worried about this issue?
I think there's no doubt that even in a state as sort of adamantly in support of abortion rights in California, as California, that this issue is going to pervade some of these midterm races. It's something that is going to motivate voters. It could particularly have an effect on suburban women who in cycle after cycle have been really key in districts like Katie Porter's in Orange County. And so I think even as there's very little likelihood that California as a state is about to backtrack on abortion access, when you were thinking about the broader national issues that encourage Democratic voters to turn out, I think this is a huge one.
So where do the two Orange County female Republicans, Congresswoman Young Kim and Michelle Steele, stand on abortion?
I have actually not seen them out there making sort of a lot of vocal public statements about it. I think the important thing to consider when it comes to Republicans in California running in these swing districts like a Michelle Steele or a Young Kim is that unlike in some other states, in California, abortion is so close to sort of a settled issue amongst voters, in particular in these sort of swing districts, that I don't think there is a lot of political upside, even if you're a Republican running in one of these districts, to really sort of taking a fervently anti-abortion stance, because that's a view that just doesn't resonate with a lot of California voters, in particular those more swing voters. And so I think this is something where you are unlikely to see Republicans running hard on their support of the Supreme Court's decision, as opposed to Democrats running on their opposition.
So will Democrats in those races make it a big issue?
I think you can count on it. And I think that we are already seeing efforts by the state legislature and the governor to put an initiative on the November ballot to constitutionally enshrine our right to abortion in California. And I think that's something that's also likely going to rally voters. So I think even beyond sort of the specific dynamics of these House races, the larger dynamics that are going to be driving voters to the polls and informing voters' decisions, I think the abortion issue and the way it plays out in California and the way Democrats respond to it is going to absolutely be a defining issue in this campaign.
All right, so let's shift to a more national focus. Just today, you saw Joe Biden say that he's going to focus on inflation, that that's his number one priority. Republicans obviously want to talk about that. They want to talk about gas prices. How big an issue is this going to be nationally, do you think?
I think it's going to be an enormous issue. And I think elections often, candidates like something that defines a clear choice, right? And I think that this action by the US Supreme Court creates that sort of clear choice potentially for voters on a really powerful issue. You know, the sort of contours of the election to this point have been sort of a referendum on Joe Biden and how voters feel about inflation and how they feel about the job that the Democrats, which is to really say Joe Biden, have done in control of government. This has the potential to shift that and make it more of which of these two paths do you want? There is a clear choice on this issue. And so to the extent that this could potentially take this election from how do voters feel about Joe Biden, which the polling tells us is not so hot, to do voters want door A or door B on abortion, I think it really has the potential to change the contours of a lot of these races.
However, James Carville famously said, it's the economy, stupid. People are concerned about the economy. That's their number one issue.
And I don't want to discount that. I think undoubtedly, if you are a voter who is struggling to fill up your car and make rent because of rising prices, for a lot of voters, that's going to be more top of mind than whether they could theoretically get an abortion at a certain number of weeks. That said, I do think it's something that with some of these swing voters or turning out more loyal Democrats who are maybe feeling discouraged given those economic headwinds, I do think it's something that is going to have a big effect on these elections.
How does redistricting figure into this when Republicans in many states control the redistricting process and have ensured that they have safe seats? Even if it is a big issue animating voters, would redistricting mean that it wouldn't have that much of a political impact?
I think redistricting in states where it is controlled politically rather than by an independent commission like in California, it always tends to produce more safe districts. And so, yes, I think absolutely in states where Republicans are in control of the redistricting process and therefore have been able to create fewer vulnerable seats, and I think the same applies for Democrats as well, that would likely mute of this or any hot issue.
What are the risks, though, for Democrats of making this a centerpiece of their campaign?
There are a lot of voters on the other side of this issue who feel strongly that abortion should be restricted more or perhaps even outlawed. And I don't know that those voters are so likely to go vote for Democrats. But if you think about this as a turnout motivator on both sides of the aisle, I think that there is in the same way that this could drive more Democrats to the polls, it could drive more Republicans to the polls who are feeling energized and who see an opportunity to create a congressional majority that would maybe help cement what the Supreme Court has done in federal law. And so I think there are potential upsides both parties on this issue in terms of rallying their base. And of course, that could mean potential downsides for the opposing party that ends up on the wrong side of that vote.
Jeremy White, California politics reporter for Politico. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the comedian Ziwei likes to examine structural racism on her show, but it's all in fun.
I think ultimately, if you're going to make someone eat vegetables, you better have a really, really good side dish.
Ziwei is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, and that means it's time for TV on the Radio.
The crown has landed on my head.
Yes, queen, yeah.
You're not a killer.
This is the way.
You have to be a killer.
There wasn't offered before me.
If you're trying to curse, you can't.
That's bullshit.
We have so many disasters bombarding us right now.
Okay, today we are going to speak with the comedian Ziwei. She came onto the scene in her YouTube show called Baited with Ziwei. And as the title suggests, she baited her guests with provocative questions that usually revolved around race.
So as an attractive white woman, how much free stuff do you get on the daily?
None.
You haven't gotten anything for free in your white life?
Yeah, I mean, pens.
Do you get pens for free? That's the most you're getting out of your white privilege is free pens.
No, that's not
Come
the
on,
most.
Work harder.
That show, now called Ziwei, has moved to a bigger screen. It's on Showtime, Sunday nights at 11, and season 2 just kicked off. Ziwei herself joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. All right, so how would you describe your show for people who haven't seen it?
I think that my show basically is uncomfortable conversations with iconic people. We really talk about the brass tacks of media and American politics and race and culture and gender and class, and it's very, very funny.
What is the area where your guests get most uncomfortable?
I think that changes for each respective guest. With someone like, a guest like Fran Lebowitz for season 1, I asked her if she preferred slow walkers or racism. And, you know, she answered that question very quickly. So that didn't make her uncomfortable at all. Whereas if I asked a guest like Chet Hanks if he wanted to apologize to any minority communities for appropriating their culture.
Big up the whole island, massive. It's your boy Chetana coming straight from the Golden Globes, you know what I'm saying?
Do you feel like you inspired a generation of boys, white boys particularly, to speak in patois?
I don't know. I think I did kind of make the patois accent more like a little more trending, I guess.
You really have to watch the show yourself and you can kind of figure it out.
Yeah. Well, so what did Fran say? I'm guessing slow walkers.
Of course he said slow walkers. Iconic. I actually appreciate that answer because it was honest. Thank you, Fran Lebowitz.
Right. And is Fran Lebowitz a bit of a comedy hero to you?
I think she's an icon. She has such, I mean, she's been in the public eye for 30 years. And so to have an interview with her where I get new different sound bites was such a pleasure. Same with Charlamagne. I interviewed Charlamagne in episode 1 of the season, and he's someone who's also been in radio forever. So catching him off guard was really fun.
Well, so you ask him about critical race theory.
I do.
And what does he say? You ask him to define it.
I do ask him to define it. Well, he gives a definition that ultimately was too boring for television.
CRT is America not wanting to tell the truth about this country, period. Mm. It's almost like they're ashamed of, you know, their past.
Yeah,
so now they're trying to redefine it.
Right. But you were actually trying to tackle a pretty serious political topic du jour, which is the politicization of CRT.
Definitely.
Yeah. And so how do you kind of balance that? So you want to talk about it, but you say, yeah, when he was giving the definition, it was kind of boring, but this is an important topic. How do you try to get across that, or do you even care, versus making it funny?
I think ultimately, if you're going to make someone eat vegetables, you better have a really, really good side dish. And so what's really nice about our show is that we have interesting, thoughtful conversations while also maintaining the fun. Comedy is supposed to make people laugh, people. And so our goal is to make people laugh first and foremost. And if ever I feel like there's learning, I like to censor my guests.
So better to laugh than to learn?
Always. I think I lead by example there, like our founding fathers. Who's to say?
Well, all of it, a lot of it is done in the editing, right? So it's you deadpanning to the camera and just having these uncomfortable pauses.
I mean, no, a lot of that is really happening in real time.
Oh, really? Yes, definitely.
I mean, because you have to understand, like, our set is really raucous, and you can hear our crew literally laughing over the course of Chet's interview, for example, or Adam Pally's interview. And so, and at one point during Chet's interview, I scream at the crew, stop laughing, you're encouraging him. I'm hyper aware as a character of the fact that I'm in front of three cameras doing an interview with a celebrity guest, and we sort of play up that chaos.
Yeah. You interviewed Gloria Steinem in the first episode of your first season, and
yes.
And you don't bait her, really.
I don't?
Well, not really.
Why do you say that?
It didn't seem that you were really baiting. It just didn't seem like you were baiting her that much. You were just kind of, you know, interviewing her in a, I don't know, in a respectful way.
I think I interview my guests in a respectful way overall, but I mean, I asked Gloria Steinem about what she thought of the song WAP by Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion. That's certainly an offbeat question, so who's to say?
Have you ever heard the song called WAP by Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion?
Yes, no, I haven't. I haven't.
I'm going to read the lyrics to you, and you tell me whether or not this is a feminist anthem. There's some in this house. There's some in this house. Now get a bucket and a mop. That's some wet. I'm talking wop, 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 that's some wet. When you hear these lyrics, do you feel empowered as a lady?
No.
No?
No, but it depends who wrote it.
Right, and she didn't like
it. One man's bait is another man's fish.
Right. So one of your favorite questions for a guest is, how many Black friends do you have? And you mainly ask white people that, right? Not Black people. Necessarily.
Well, that's not true. I ask all of my guests that. Yes.
Oh, all of your guests. Okay.
Yeah. So in episode one, I interview my writer, Aiku Famadu, about critical race theory, which he does not know the definition of.
What it is not is a catch-all term for everything.
Oh.
And has been around for a while.
How long?
Since the late 1970s. Pretty confident about that.
Did you get that on the Wikipedia page?
I don't want to divulge my sources.
How many Black friends do you have?
I have too many to count.
And then he folds his arms up behind his head and relaxes in a reclining seat. It's absolutely absurd. There's no right answer to the question, so that's why I like to. I'm kind of an equal opportunity investigator in this respect.
Right. And I think it's interesting that you found that many white people answer 4 to 5. Why do you think that is the magic number?
I don't understand the phenomenon at all. Honestly, over the course of the pandemic, I asked that to respective guests. And at first it was one is something you notice, two is okay, kind of strange. And then three becomes a trend. So I cannot say definitively. I think you'd have to ask my guests that.
Yeah. So did you ask Alison Roman that, the cookbook author?
I did.
Yeah. And she said 4 to 5. And again, you pointed out the trend, and she seemed as befuddled as you were as to why that happened.
Yeah, it's honestly really iconic, but I appreciate everyone who has 4 to 5. I hope that I can be someone's 4 to 5 Black friend out there.
How many Black friends do you have?
You know, too many to count. Reclines in seat.
How much of the show is scripted?
I mean, the sketches are scripted, but we have improvisation. Mm-hmm. We write the questions, but then you ask follow-ups that lead you to a different place. So we have a really strong foundation. And then on the day of the show, whenever we're shooting it, we go in and we kind of just play. And we find things in the room. And that's kind of the chaos and the magic of the show that feels like something that's never been done before.
So talk about this, how the show came to be. How did you come up with this idea, the baited idea?
I think a lifetime of having people randomly tell me how many Black friends they have at a Chili's. Certainly not understanding why they would mention this to me at all. And so I just had a lifetime of being sort of uncomfortable and having to have these weird, awkward conversations about race that finally I put pen to paper and made a television show about it.
Why do you think that people were interested in saying that to you?
I think that I am no different than most people. I exist in society. And what you learn about society is that sometimes people say things that make no sense. And sometimes the things that make no sense are said over and over again to make a lifetime of illogic. And so that was really, that's, I can't explain it. I don't know why people offer these weird things to me, but I run with it in this television show. I guess I would say that I'm lucky. I'm lucky that people feel so uncomfortable that they feel comfortable saying things that are inappropriate.
And how do you get people who know about the show to want to submit to these questions now, to come on your show and possibly be in the hot seat?
I ask them, honestly, these are all consenting adults, believe it or not. I do not hogtie them and throw them in front of a camera. they know the premise. They know the joke. We do pre-interviews. So they are willing and ready participants. And I think what's really iconic about them is that they're willing to poke at themselves and have fun and not do the standard celebrity interview where they promote their respective book or music or television show or film and just kind of enter into chaos and watch some really interesting art and comedy form.
And who is your ideal guest?
There are so many iconic guests. Kim Kardashian is an iconic guest. Ellen DeGeneres is an iconic guest. Elizabeth Holmes. The list goes on and on and on. Azealia Banks. I've interviewed less people than there are on planet Earth. So until I talk to every single person on this Earth, I will have not done my job.
So your show can get pretty provocative, as we've just discussed. Is there anything that Showtime has said to you, like, oh, you gotta leave that, you can't air that?
Honestly, they're really, really collaborative. And so Showtime bought the show as a series order off of an Instagram Live. So they've been really, really supportive about the show and really let us play and have offered some really interesting ideas. So I have nothing but thankful for the experience I've had with the network.
So tell me more about the season and who's on it and what some of the questions are.
Okay. So, I'm really excited to talk to Ilana Glazer from Broad City, Hannibal Buress, who's also on Broad City. Who else?
Dumois. He plays her boyfriend.
Yeah, he plays her boyfriend. Dumois, who is the sort of like opaque digital person who documents celebrities' lives and posts about them on Instagram stories, as well as Katya Zlamajakova, who's this famous drag queen from RuPaul's Drag Race. What's really nice is that we have a myriad of guests, and it kind of covers all of the audiences in the world, every single one of them.
How did you first get into the comedy world in the first place? Because I understand you studied poetry in college. How did you transition into the comedy world?
Well, so I studied poetry, and very quickly I realized that poets don't make any money. And so I thought, what's the closest thing to poetry? Comedy. It's about the economy of words. And so I applied to an internship at Comedy Central that I read that Donald Glover had done. And then I got the internship and was at Daily Show and Colbert and in the marketing department and just like watching Comedy Central and like the different rungs and the different like avenues of entertainment. And I was a really chatty intern. I got a joke on the Colbert Report, and the rest was sort of history after that. I interned at the
Onion. What was that joke?
It was a joke about Prop 8. It was the week of Prop 8, and there was a lower third that said gay set match. And so that was the joke I pitched.
Prop 8 here in California.
Yes, exactly. No.
So that really launched you, just that one line, gay set match?
Honestly, it was more of the confidence of understanding that television working in the entertainment industry wasn't this elusive, it wasn't so elusive. It wasn't beyond something I could ever achieve. It was actually really human. And there were people behind these desks writing. And so, and being able to do that at 20, 21 years old, and I had the confidence to go apply for The Onion, which was a publication I really respected. And then I started writing there. And then I moved to New York City and I worked my way up at Above Average, and then wrote for DeSimero and then Rundown with Robin Thede and then Cartoon President and Dickinson. And so all of those things were just an amalgamation of me like really trying things out and working really hard over the course of 10 years to become this overnight success.
Okay, so what's next for the overnight success?
World domination. I plan on running for presidency. I think that, 2024
we need a Bratz doll in the White House, and I hope to be that person.
Or Donald Trump.
Hey.
One of the two.
Hey. There are worse choices.
All right. Well, ZY, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was honestly such a pleasure, truly.
ZY airs Sunday nights at 11 on Showtime. Coming up, an Andy Warhol painting of Marilyn Monroe sold for a record amount at Christie's yesterday, but Warhol didn't consider it one of his best. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. An Andy Warhol silkscreen portrait of Marilyn Monroe sold for $195 million last night at Christie's. It's an auction record for an American artist. The 1964 portrait was made after Monroe's death. It's one of the most recognizable paintings. It's a portrait of her, slightly smiling. Her face is pink, her hair bright yellow, her eyeshadow sky blue, her lips deep red, and it's set against an aqua-colored background. Warhol had done the same silk screen 2 years earlier, but with different colored backgrounds and with some flaws in those works, flaws that alluded to Monroe's decline as a movie star. And those sold for a little more than $200. In the work sold last night, Warhol had removed the flaws and thereby changed the meaning of the image, according to my next guest, New York Times art critic Blake Gopnik. He is also the author of the biography, Warhol, A Life as Art. Welcome.
Hey, Madeline, such a pleasure to talk to you.
Great to have you. All right, so talk about this one that sold last night. It's not the only one of its kind in existence, right? There are four others?
Yeah, get ready. This gets kind of complicated. So Warhol begins to silkscreen Marilyn sometime in the summer of 1962, maybe the day after she died, if you believe the myths, or maybe a good bit before that, we just don't know. He makes a bunch of Marilyns, puts them in his first ever New York solo show that happened that fall of 62. And then everything changes. Pop art becomes kind of an everyday phenomenon. And Warhol picks up again on Marilyn in 1964, and he makes what I call retreads of the earlier paintings. He does repeats, and he actually, apparently around the studio, called these later ones dead paintings. In a way, he had a kind of contempt for them, because of course, they weren't original. You know, originality is so important for 20th century art, for modern art. And by definition, these things, which are, you know, mildly altered repeats of the 1962 pictures, well, they're obviously not original in that sense. But actually, I argue that that's what makes them interesting. That's what makes them important.
Yeah. It's kind of part of his whole thing, right? About how pop art and just everyday objects, the repetition of it, it just becomes art in and of itself, just the mere repetition of it. But what, so the one that sold last night is a retread, according to you.
Yeah, that's I guess you could say that was a cruel term. You know, it's better looking than the 1962 version. And some people have come after me saying, well, wait a minute, you know, the 64 version's way more beautiful. And I say, well, that's just the point, because Warhol wasn't about conservative notions like the beautiful or, for that matter, the sublime. He was interested in things that were more complex than that. He was more interested in reproduction and reproducibility than he was in, you know, traditional notions of innovation.
So why did he make this second batch in 1964?
Well, you come at that from two angles. Either because he wanted the money. I actually was able to dig out the circumstances of the commission of these 1964 Marilyns. It wasn't his idea. Someone came to him and said, look, I think I can get a buyer if you can make some new, bigger Marilyns than you did in 62. So, you know, here, I'll pay you. And turns out, actually, the money was fronted by Fidel Castro's former brother-in-law, fronted the money to pay Warhol to make these five copies of Marilyn. But, you know, in the back of his mind, I think Warhol knew that this would be more interesting, that copying, that appropriating his one work. I mean, he's the great appropriation artist. So I thought he realized that appropriating his own work, a kind of appropriation cubed, would actually make it one of his most important works. So in a way, the worse the 1964 picture is, the better it is at the same time. And that's maybe why it actually deserved to sell for $195 million, if anything does. I mean, I don't think anything Wow. Deserves that kind of money spent on it.
Well, okay. Can you describe just the differences between the 62 version and this version in aesthetically? Which one do you, first, which one do you like better? And just describe how they differ.
Oh, you know, like better. It depends on I guess, what mood I'm in, whether it's morning or evening. The 62 ones are tough as nails. They're deliberately badly silkscreened. Not by accident. He was a highly trained artist who learned all about silkscreening in college yet. But he wanted them to have a kind of toughness to them. I think that, you know, there are gaps in it because they're so badly silkscreened, gaps in the image, and then the ink pools in other areas. They look a mess, and of course, Marilyn Monroe was a mess by 1962. Whether he silkscreened her before she died or afterwards doesn't really matter. Everyone knew that Marilyn was falling apart. She wasn't the star she'd been even a few years earlier. And I think that he captured that really poignant sense in them. Now, you could say that that's very un-Warholian, right? That Warhol's not about those traditional values, you know, romantic pathos, all of that. And that when he cleans them up 2 years later, when he makes them into things that are, in a sense, pure image, that are kind of sparkly, like Marilyn herself was at her most popular moment, then he's really Warholian. Then he's channeling popular culture. Instead of coming at pop culture from on high, he's really channeling what people want from pop culture, a kind of superficiality. And that makes the 64 Marilyn's more Warholian, I'd say.
The glossiness of it, the impenetrability of it.
Yeah, exactly. And in a way, I hate that about them. I mean, they're very beauty, if you want to use that word. I guess I'd use the word prettiness. It sort of turns me off, but the 64 Marilyn's are kind of irresistible. The earlier ones are tough. They're much more like traditionally great 20th century modern art, more like Picasso in a way. And then Warhol pulls away from that and inhabits the superficiality of pop culture by 64. And he's doing that himself. He's, you know, as his persona develops, he adopts that, the silly leather jacket wearing guy with a blonde mop on top. He really doesn't adopt that until he's done with pop art. And that's also part of inhabiting popular culture, of being as goofy as, you know, Gilligan's Island or the Monkees.
Why is this one called Shot Sage Blue Marilyn?
It shouldn't be, because it was never shot. It was one of this series of five Marilyns that he made in 64. And a bunch of them were stacked on the wall of his studio when a woman called Dorothy Podber, who was kind of the most radical, crazy, wild avant-gardist in New York, she owned an ocelot as a pet, and she used to eat speed like candy. But she walked into the studio one day, pulled out a gun, and shot this stack of Marilyns right through the forehead. And everyone sort of imagined that she'd shot through all of them. This one bears no traces that it was ever shot, so it must have not been in the pile. But an early art historian, you know, writing in the early 70s, assumed that it was one of the shot ones and gave it the name, but it's a misnomer. The thing was never actually shot.
Ah, okay. So it was auctioned off in, well, the speed of what might be a shot, 4 minutes. What did you think of that? Did you anticipate it would sell so fast and for so much money?
I anticipated it would sell for so much money because when you got pictures like this, trophy pictures, it's often the case that people want to pay more for them rather than paying less for them, right? There's no fun in owning the fourth most expensive picture in history, right? When you get up there, when you own the most valuable work of modern art in all of history, when it beats a Picasso that sold for $180 million a while ago, then you've really got something. So it needed to make a record. There's no doubt about that. Didn't beat the Leonardo, the lousy Leonardo that sold, you know, what was that, 3 years ago for $450 million.
And I guess Salvatore Mundi, yeah.
Yeah, as a Warhol expert, I was kind of disappointed that it didn't beat Leonardo. But, you know, in my Warhol biography, at the very last sentence, I think, of the whole book, I say that I thought Warhol had surpassed Picasso as the most influential artist of the 20th century, and a lot of people were up in arms about that. How could you possibly say that he's greater than Picasso? Well, the art market is always dumb, so I shouldn't quote the art market, but at least it's backing me up on this one issue of excellence.
I guess money does talk. He knew that for sure, Andy Warhol. Who bought it, by the way?
You know, I don't think we know, unless someone's tweeted it out very recently. We know that the bidder on it was Larry Gagosian, the mega dealer. But I don't know if we figured out yet, or if he's revealed, or if anyone's winkled out the information about who he was buying it for, because I don't think he was buying it for himself. But I bet we'll eventually know. Those things usually leak.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Blake, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Absolute pleasure being on with you. Thanks a lot.
That's Blake Gopnik, art critic for the New York Times and author of Warhol, A Life as Art. You're listening to KCRW during our spring pledge drive. We are not asking for $195 million, just a fraction of that for your support, for keeping the lights on in this place. We are here for you with a programming you love. So now we come to you a couple times a year to ask you to be there for us. Donate now at kcrw.com/give, 800-600-5279. When you go online, you can check out all our new merch. We always have new merch for a fundraiser, so that's a good thing. Check it out. Maybe pick up a t-shirt or a new hat, whatever you want. kcrw.com/give. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.